you want the chair.
No, just there. Hello, this is Dave Siegel, and I have the distinct privilege of having as my guest on this Saturday, June 9, 1984, Mr. Ward Byron. Ward has been associated with the golden age of radio and has a particularly rewarding relationship with some of the world's greatest jazz musicians as they share their talents with radio audiences. Ward, can you tell us how you got started in show business in general and in radio broadcasting in particular?
Okay, Dave, it's a pleasure to be here with you and to be in this library of yours, or should say storehouse of tapes such as I've never seen before. I've never seen such a collection. I'm overpowered by it, and the fact that you've dug up things that I've been looking for years is just icing on the cake on this visit and seeing you. But now you ask about getting into radio and all that. I don't know how interesting that would be, except that as a kid I had a kid band, a college band allegedly, and went to Europe with them in 1929 and 1930. We played on the Cunard line, and so I always had a love of music. And headed right from, it was a case of should I go to college or should I go in for music, and the music won out, but not from the standpoint of a performer, but from the standpoint of being behind the microphone. I went with WEAF and 195 Broadway at that time, that was owned by AT&T, so I was with NBC 6 months before NBC was born. So from that, I learned to the fact that I had loved music, and I even studied voice for quite some time, was going to be the next John Charles Byron, and found out that I'd much rather be behind the microphone. So, in fact, my voice wasn't up to it, let's face it. So that was the start, and then I went up with when NBC was formed, we went to 711 Fifth Avenue and became the Red and Blue Network, as you remember, Red being WEAF, combined with the Westinghouse station of WJZ, which was the Blue Network. So from there on, I got mixed up with Raymond Knight, who was probably the fount of all comedy in television, radio, or whatever, the electronic medium, let's say. He was the real source of it all, because Ray was did a show called The Cuckoo Hour. Now, this predated any of the Jack Bennies, Eddie Cantors, or anything, anyone of that type. And it was a nonsense, wild, crazy show that just I loved. I went in for that and got to know Ray well. Finally, we became partners, and I left NBC and went with Ray and did the program with him. And we did a daytime serial, too, for kids. So that's back in the early 30s.
Do you remember the name of the daytime serial that you did?
Yes, the daytime serial was Wheatinaville, or Billy Batchelor and the Twins. And if any recording of that could be found, I think it should be destroyed immediately, if it hasn't already self-destructed. As a matter of fact, though, it was not a soaper the way other soapers were. It was a comedy soaper with kids. He was a bachelor with two children, and he played it for light, for laughs and humor, rather than any of the weepies that came with most of the soaps. So I'm getting way off the track. The thing I wanted to that brought me up to see Dave was the fact that he had chamber music at Lower Basin Street. Now, there is quite a history to this that involves a lot more than my participation in it, and that is the fact that it's almost a person going full cycle and involving people full cycle in this thing that could become rather interesting to anyone studying radio, because some of the things, I think, were the first time they ever happened in radio. I had come on, left Raymond Knight in 1935 to go to NBC in San Francisco, KPO and KGO. That's the Red KPO and the Blue KGO. Now, on arrival out there, I ran into a chap, Jack Meekin, who was associate director and arranger for Meredith Wilson. And Jack was, and I just became the very closest of buddies. He had was doing a program called Bughouse Rhythm that had been created by Jack and a boy, Joe Thompson. Now, Joe Thompson now has a program of his own on the public radio station in San Francisco. I don't know the call letters. Do you know, Dave? Anyway, it's a San Francisco, and it's called Joe Thompson's Music Room. And he and Jack had dreamed up this idea of treating the gut bucket, low-down jazz of the day with the dignity of Toscanini, an appearance by Toscanini, but announcing things in a very straight way. Well, I had just come from New York, where Ray Knight and I had done 3 years, once a year, a program with the Metropolitan Opera, which was called Opportunities. And we had the full cast of the Metropolitan Opera, the entire cast and orchestra and everyone to work with. And it was one of the greatest fun times of my life. In fact, no one remembers it because it was not broadcast. It was just for the Metropolitan Opera Fund and quite expensive, the tickets, and we packed it wall to wall each year with this burlesque party of the opera. Well, the surprising thing was that people never realized that opera stars are human beings, and they like to laugh, and they don't have to be bowed and say, Madam and Madam so-and-so. Lily Pons was Lily, a great gal, wonderful gal. She loved 52nd Street, where we'd take her in the old days to hear jazz, because no one would think of her doing things like that. But they loved to participate in this show. Well, it turns out that that was practically the same idea as Joe Thompson and Jack Meekin were doing with Bughouse Rhythm. So now Joe left for some reason. I don't recall whether he left the company or went away. Or anyway, I took the program over. So I had it from 1936 to the end of the series when I left KPO and went with Music Corporation of America. But we did the program with Jack Meekin as the orchestra leader, became Dr. John Brunker Meekin. Archie Presby, the announcer, became G. Archibald Presby. And we were very purist in the presentation of this whole idea. The fact that we never allowed any laughs, we had commentary on all the numbers, and the names were given never Duke Ellington, but Edgar Kennedy Ellington. And we never allowed laughs or clowning in the program. So weeks would go by, and we'd get letters from people saying, we didn't know you were kidding. And all of a sudden, it would dawn on them what it was going on, and they would roar and laugh at the thing. Well, it was perfect for my type of enjoyment, because I had just come from the Metropolitan Opera with all the seriousness that things were treated in that in those days by announcers, speaking with awe about the performers and the Richard Wagner and the Milton Crosses, who was a wonderful guy. I love Milton. And we were ribbing Milton. We were doing it with kindness, never a thing, but we were ribbing the whole pretense of classical music, was a general idea. Now, the thing that makes, I think, an interesting story is the fact that I left it to go with Music Corporation, left NBC, and Jack Meekin left, I guess, KPO about 6 months or a year later. And he came to New York, and he tried to form a band, but just didn't have too much success with that. In fact, you need an awful lot of backing for that, because he had a wonderful band, actually. But he finally was looking for work, and I introduced him to the program director at NBC. So the next thing you know, he's a NBC producer in New York. So I was on the road with the Fitch bandwagon, you may remember, which played all over the country and played every name band in America. And so I was called one day by the program director, who said, we'd like to bring back that chamber music of Lower Basin Street. And I said, great, love to do it. They said, well, it's a sustaining program, and you know what it pays. As a matter of fact, I think it was about $25 for a script. But I said, I'd do it for nothing. We had such fun. So I wrote the script for it and prepared to the first program for the idea of chamber of Bughouse Rhythm, rather. And a week later, the program director called me practically in tears. He was so embarrassed, says, Ward, I don't know how to even tell you this, but he says, what happened at the program meeting was that one Lewis Titterton, who was head of continuity acceptance at NBC, stood up at the meeting and said, yes, I think it's a great idea to bring back Bughouse Rhythm, but does Ward Byron own that thing? He says, now, Ward is an old friend of mine. He says, but I'm working for NBC. He's not. Now, doesn't NBC own this program? Why do we have to have Ward Byron do it? So he says, Lewis won the point, and his writers were to take the program over. And he says, I just can't face you having gotten into this. And I said, well, actually, here it is. So there's no embarrassment, and you won't feel bad. Here's a present. Here's the first script. So I gave him the first script.
Do you recall what year this was, Ward?
Yes, that would have been 1941, I'd say. 40, 41. It started in 40 or 41. I don't remember which, but it was one of those years. So anyway, he said, well, we'll take it. And I said, now, on one condition, I'll give you this, and then you don't have to be embarrassed. Whenever I'm in town, I want to go on the program for nothing. I don't care if it's pay or not. I want to be the intermission commentator, musicologist, just for kicks and for fun. And so he says, you got it. So every time I was in New York, I would go on in the intermission spot of Chamber Music Society of Lower Basin Street. And I was introduced, I believe, as Dr. Ward Byron, musicologist, who will present, will read from his 6-foot book of, five-foot book of shelves on how to tell a downbeat from a boiled owl.
And you're really saying that they stole the program from you.
They didn't steal it because it was their show. I did it as an employee of NBC. They owned it
when
it was Bughouse Rhythm. So they brought it back. They did change the title, though. So anyway, I would go on with that, with my commentary, and do the ridiculous spot of intermission, the way the opera would have their intermission and with Milton Cross, and then they'd go on to an opera quiz and all that. So we kept that intact. However, it had turned into not the purest show that Bughouse Rhythm was, because they allowed laughs, allowed an audience to laugh, so no one was was led astray by hearing this nonsense and wondering what it was all about. They had even had Zero Mostel and noted comics on, and everybody became doctor instead of just Dr. John Brunker Meakin, the leader, which we were doing, of course, Dr. Damrosch, Walter Damrosch in his day. We were referring to that sort of presentation. But now, the thing that, getting back to it, I keep wandering, but coming back to the thing that I say goes full cycle, the remarkable thing is, as I think back, that when I'd come on and do my intermission spot, here I am in New York on the microphone out front, and Dr. John Brunker Meakin is the producer sitting in the booth, who had been the original Dr. Meakin of Bughouse Rhythm. So he's looking at me through the glass window, and I'm out there, which is such a strange switch in radio. And as far as I know, maybe it's the first time it ever happened. Maybe it should be the last.
A little role reversal.
Yeah, complete role reversal.
Or okay, when we broke you, I think you were just about to talk about how you got involved with the Fitch radio show.
All right. The Fitch bandwagon, I think, is memorable, at least to me, heavens knows. For 6 years it provided a very good income and a way of life, traveling all over the country and even Canada, doing a different name band every week. Of course, in 6 years we repeated many of them. The Dorseys would visit again, and Benny Goodman, and all of the biggest name bands would be on once or twice a year at times. But the story of how it originated might be interesting to those who follow the devious methods of radio broadcasting booking, is the fact that MCA had gone to the Fitch Company, the Chicago office of MCA, with an idea. They said, we will, for X number of dollars per week, we will deliver one of the top name bands of the country. Well, in 1938, this was, to 39, name bands were pretty big. Records were booming, and the Dorseys and Goodmans and all were kings of the mountain. So they said, great, we'll do it. So the remarkable thing is that to people in these days is the fact that a contract was signed, the starting date of September, I believe, of 1938, was all set, but they had no program. So they came to me because I had been working for MCA. I had done the Elizabeth Arden show with Eddie Duchin and Buddy Rogers and a few of those. So they said, you've got a program. And I said, what is it? And they said, well, we're going to call it the Fitch Bandwagon. So I took it over from there, and I did the script. And then they said, well, we ought to have an audition. So we auditioned. The first original script of the Fitch Bandwagon was to be Guy Lombardo. Well, Guy was a little too big to audition. Why should he go through all this of script and doing lines and so forth in the history of his life and band? So the Fitch Company wanted to hear approximately what it would be like. So Frankie Masters in Chicago did the very first show, and he played Guy Lombardo, and the members of his band boys played Carmen and Liebert and so forth, and we did the script as though it was Lombardo. And the Fitch people were down in the client's room at the Merchandise Mart in Chicago, and they heard the thing and said, great. So we went on the air, and it went on for 6 years. But the thing that I think would shock all of those engaging in this pursuit these days is the fact that no lawyers, no long contracts, no six auditions with the client changing things here and there. It just is remarkable to think of how casually the show went on. Is that the story you wanted?
Well, that's the story I got.
In other words, you don't want it.
It's a good one. I'm interested, and I think anyone who loves old radio as I do, in learning about as many of the broadcasts that you were associated with any little human interest stories that you can give us about them. For example, you've indicated you've been on Bughouse Rhythm, and you practically created the program. Whether you say so or not, I got the feeling that NBC swiped chamber music from you. Mm-hmm. You were active with the very, very first Fitch shows. You did that the daytime kid serial, Weetinaville. What other programs have you been associated with, Ward, and in what manner? You've written some, directed some. Have you done any production? Have you? What are some of the other shows you've been involved with?
Well, I think I actually, Dave, I did I wrote and directed all my shows. The only time I didn't write programs was when I got into television. I did the Amici Langford show out of the little theater next door to Sardi's in television.
Was that Bickerson's?
No, this Bickerson's was their radio career, and they used it in guest appearances once in a while, I think, in television. But we didn't do the Bickerson's. There was some contractual problem with the thing. But we had Tony Romano and his fix a band. He had traveled with Bob Hope and Francis in Europe, and we were on 5 days a week. But now that I had writers for, but the distinction of that show is that I think it was the first real television exposure, although he had done single dramatic shows here and there, but it was the first real exposure of Jack Lemmon. Jack did a sketch on the thing 5 days a week with his wife, his first wife, Cynthia, and it was called The Couple Next Door, and it was a joy. Jack was one of the most talented people in the world. So that's the distinction that show had.
Of course, when radio people think of The Couple Next Door, they think of Peg Lynch.
That's right.
And
yeah.
Alan Bunt.
Right. Well, we stole the title. Or I think it was The Couple Next Door. Maybe I'm misquoting. It was a couple. Yeah, I'm quite sure. Anyway, it was a segment of the Amici Langford show out of the little theater on 44th Street. Yeah, that was television. But that I didn't write. I had writers for that. I was just producer on. But I did write the Goodyear Paul Whiteman Goodyear Review in 1950 to 52. That was in television. That was out of the biggest studio then in New York for television. That was the ABC studio at 66th Street, because NBC didn't come in with the Brooklyn facilities till a year or so later, so we had the largest studio facility for television in the country at that time.
Speaking of Paul Whiteman, as you know, you're credited with writing some of the early Whiteman radio programs, the Forever Pops programs, the Stairway to the Stars. Could you tell us a little bit about the programs and about Paul Whiteman, and what was he like to work with?
You're the one that told me I did those, and thank you for doing it. I'd forgotten all about them, and I'm delighted to have the shows. I remembered that I did them, but I have very faint recollection of them. But there's nothing faint in recollections about Paul Whiteman, because he was... Were you through with the reel, or are we doing another?
Oh.
So he was a giant in the industry, and someday will be really given the recognition he deserves. Maybe a complete hour special in television should be done for him, because there's a very excellent book out now by Tom DeLong called Pops, the biography of Paul Whiteman. People don't realize what an influence this man was in the industry, in the business, because they think of him as king of jazz, and then they say, why, he wasn't jazz, as all jazz musicians resent that title. But jazz was an all-encompassing title in those days. Jazz meant ragtime, popular, anything in the world. So that's how he got tagged. Paul didn't like the King of Jazz title himself very much. But I'll tell you one story that people have never brought out. And that is that to this day, probably every musician, popular musician alive, doesn't realize how much they owe to Paul Whiteman for their position in life. Now, back in the 20s, when ragtime and jazz boys came up for the river from New Orleans and from St. Louis and Chicago, they were not the Ozzie Nelsons. They were not the Rudy Vallées. They were not college bred. They were not Ivy League. They were poison Ivy League. They were a different breed of cat than you met with than we got into in the 30s. So that when, if you recall the pictures, you see old movies, when a band played at Rector's or at any of the famous places in New York, they'd be on a balcony or they'd be in back of potted palms. They kind of hid them as third-class citizens. You just never considered them as part of a party. Now, I know, because in the 20s I mentioned before, a little band that we called a college band, because one boy was from Brown, another from Princeton. Brown, we liked the name, so we called it the Little Brown Jugglers. But I know because I'm sure, were hired by many of the nice social parties in Long Island and Jersey, not on the strength of our music, but on the fact that the hostess figured she didn't have to count the silverware when we left. You know, that was the criteria for choosing a band. Now, along comes the much publicized concert, justifiably publicized, of the Aeolian Hall recital, where Pops did the first concert of popular music, in which Gershwin presented the Rhapsody in Blue. Well, now, in that audience, you had Walter Damrosch, who was known as the Dean of Music, of popular music, opera and concert and so forth. You had these people of that sort, Deems Taylor, rubbing shoulders with jazz musicians in the audience. Everybody came. It was a mixture. But after the concert, a strange thing happened. The jazz musician came out from behind the potted palms. He became no longer a third-class citizen, and a better class of people went in for music because it was no longer considered lowbrow. So to this day, of course, it might have happened without Pops in some other way, but by gosh, he was the first one to really start the movement going of where people accepted musicians as their fellow human beings. They no longer hid them. So that is one of the things that people should remember about Paul Whiteman. As for himself, he was a Rabelaisian character. There's no doubt about that. He used to say, when someone said, when you spoke of Jackie Gleason or Dean Martin on consuming alcohol, Pops would say, "Hell, I've spilled more than they drank." And he was a lusty guy. There's no hiding that, anything about it. But it fit him. He was a big man. He lived a big life. He was a big picture in everything he did. I can think of one story about him where he came after one terrible episode where he'd become like a little boy who'd been caught with his hand in the cookie bowl. He was so contrite and felt so badly after having misbehaved and had a little too much to drink. For days he would just condemn himself and say what a terrible person he was and how awful he was. So one day we're having lunch after such a session, and he was continuing to run himself down into how life has been good to him and why is he such a no-good bum, and I'd say, "Oh, come on, Bob." So suddenly he brightened, and he said, "You know, Spook," he called me Spook, because everything Pops said had a reason. I wrote for him, therefore I'm a ghostwriter, therefore I'm a Spook. So my nickname was Spook. So he said, "You know, Spook, with Detroit and assembly lines, interchangeable parts, good Lord, wouldn't you think that by this time they could unhook a person up at the throat here and unhook them at the bottom and put in a whole new set of plumbing?" And I said, "Yeah, that sounds very logical, Pops. I wanted to get back to a script we were working on." And he sat there and kind of thought it over, and then a beautiful smile came over his face. He says, "You know, when they do, I'm going to go out and ruin it all over again." So now, how can you hate a man like that?
That's amusing, particularly since some of the stories that are told about Paul Whiteman are told in relationship to his early contacts with Bing Crosby, and how he was more the master and Bing Crosby was the cut-up. And the stories that I've heard deal with Whiteman getting on Crosby's tail for some of the things that Crosby and his crew would do, and now you're telling me that Whiteman was just as capable of cutting up as the people who worked for him.
Sure he was, but then, after all, he's the boss, and he did have to get after Bing on many things, many episodes, but also, I think Bing owed a great deal to him that people don't realize. Now, I'm sure Bing might have developed it by himself, his wonderful use of words, his throwing around phrases, little catchphrases. That was developed by a lot of writers for him, too, that saw his love of this, of language. But Pops was that way, and I think Bing might have caught a bit of it from him. Everything with Pop was a swing-a-ring-a-rooer, and he had a wonderful way of speech, of things you'd never think of describing scenes or something. He'd have colorful speech, and I think that Bing picked up a great deal of that from him. Granted, I think he developed it further and perfected it further than Pops did, but Pops was a wonderful slinger of words in that kind of style. Now, Carol Carroll, the writer in Hollywood of many, many radio shows, one of the great writers of all time out there, for my money, I used to think Carol must have slept under Bing's bed, hid in the closets, because he got to use in the scripts the language that fit Bing so perfectly, and I think he picked up a lot right from Bing's own expressions, and Taylor didn't have to tailor them for him. But all of that was very much a part of Pops Whiteman's speech, too, the same sort of thing, but not quite as highly developed.
You also worked, you have indicated, with Perry Como on the Chesterfield Hour. How did you get to develop that relationship with Como, and what was it like working with him?
Well, Perry, I had worked with him, of course, before I did the Chesterfield, because when he was singing with Ted Weems' band, I'd done one, two, maybe three programs with during the 6 years of Fitch, so I knew Perry from that, knew him quite well. But I think what happened again was saving money. Perry was to go out to do If I'm Lucky, a motion picture with what's her name that played in Guys and Dolls? Vivian Blaine. Vivian, and he was to do the movie there and to go to the coast. That meant the Chesterfield Supper Club had to be put on from the coast. So to save sending a writer, a director, and a producer out, they said, this guy claims to do them all, which I had been doing. So I went out as probably a money-saving device, where I wrote, produced, and directed the shows, and went along with Perry on that trip. Then I continued on when we came back to New York and stayed with him right until I left to go into television in 1949.
Now, you talked about money earlier when you commented on, I think, $25 a show that you got for some of the earlier programs. Could you, for those of us who are interested in the economics of radio, we know that there were stars that made quite a bit of money, the Eddie Cantors and the Al Jolsons. What was the economics of radio for those people who were in the background? Was there a great deal of money? Was it how did it develop? Was did AFTRA have anything to do with changing any of that? And could you maybe talk about the role of AFTRA?
No, not so much. AFTRA didn't have that, although later it came in the Writers Guild. They have jurisdiction over such things these days. But no, I'd say writers and producers and all did well on the big shows. The $25 I mentioned, Dave, was for a sustaining bit, you see. A little filler program, which was all that chamber music at Lower Basin Street was at that time, was, I believe, on the Blue Network. Maybe it was on Red. I think it played both networks at times. But that was, now, certainly the man that wrote it that I told the story about taking over the script, his name was Wayburn Kelly. Wonderful, very, very good guy, good writer who took it over, but he was employed by NBC. He was in the script department, so I don't know what his salary was, but I'm quite sure he didn't make any money doing the program, but because I was an outsider and contributed my spot, they had to pay me something, and it was about $25 because it was a sustaining program.
What you're saying then is that if someone were just on the NBC staff, whether as an announcer or a writer, they would take whatever assignments came to them and would not necessarily receive extra remuneration for that show.
Oh, no, that's not so. The sustaining shows, they were not paid for. They were just received their salary. But nearly all were auditioned for the bigger shows. City Service or any show that came along would have auditions announcers, and they got an extra fee from that client for doing the show. So all the bigger commercial programs had their own announcer. My announcer in New York for Fitch was Jack Costello, if you remember. Mm-hmm. And in the coast, I had Larry Keating, and I had Dresser Dahlstedt. They all received, we paid them a fee, although they were on staff there, but because they had been presented by NBC, offered by NBC to the auditions, and they won the part, and they got paid for it.
Were you involved in active production during the Petrillo period and during the the strike of the musicians?
Oh, yes, very much so, because those were the days when everybody remembers we were all playing Genie with the Light Brown Hair, and there's a tavern in the town, and the arrangements had to be made of all the old standards, folk songs, everything else that were not controlled by ASCAP. So we were getting pretty tired of the material. So I went through that period. But then, in fact, that was the period that created BMI, who the networks sponsored or furthered their cause, got in back of them, and they, for the first time, ASCAP had a competition.
What is BMI? I'm not familiar with
Broadcast Music Incorporated.
I see.
And they are now very, very big. They have a tremendous library, and many of the artists signed with them who were not getting any work with ASCAP out on strike, and so that became quite a problem for programming, because things were getting to sound pretty much alike.
Well, after a 2 or 3 minute break here to take care of some technical problems, we're back on with the most generous person who I have ever met associated with the golden age of radio, Ward Byron. And Ward is being kind enough to share some of his memories with me and with anyone who is fortunate enough to be able to listen to this tape of some of the great musicians of the 1930s and 40s and 50s. Ward, rather than asking about specific programs, can you tell me and who were some of the musicians that you really felt pride and a pleasure working with, and who were some that you perhaps preferred not to work with, but had to nonetheless, and perhaps why?
Well,
I'm putting you on the spot because, as we said earlier, people like to hear some of the gossip of the days of yesterday.
Well, I'd say that all in all, most of them were great. There were ones that if your musical tastes were not the same, you'd try to duck them. That the greats were really great. I'd say one of the greatest, and of course you can't say he doesn't get the credit, because he does, is Artie Shaw. Artie was absolutely far head and shoulders over the usual crowd of musicians, in that he had so many other avenues to his talents. And controversial or not, sometimes he'd drive you crazy with his persistence in following some damn thing that nobody else was interested in, but he was extremely well-informed and was an all-around talented guy. I hate to use the old expression, a Renaissance man, because it's used lightly everywhere. But for people that want to use it lightly, Artie would be qualified for that, because he was a very amazing guy, and anyone that has heard him talk knows that. He'll talk for any subject endlessly, and interestingly, too, I may say. For the musicians, I think Tommy Dorsey and Jimmy. Tommy, Jimmy, certainly Benny Goodman are among the tops. Harry James, oh, I loved Harry James's trumpet, although I can tell one story that maybe musicians don't know about Harry James. Once a year on the old Fitch bandwagon, we did the Ringling Brothers Barnum Bailey Circus, and that was a interesting thing. I have nothing to do with name bands, and it was one of the most popular shows each year. And the leader was Merrill Evans, who had done it for I can't think how many years. It must have been 30, 40 years.
Wasn't he the ringmaster?
No, he was the band leader. Ringmasters, they changed occasionally, but okay. Merrill Evans had the Ringling Brothers Barnum Bailey Band. And the stories that he told about musicians, how they're out in the rain, the cold, they're parading, they're doing everything in the world and still batting out these powerful marches and gallops that they play for circuses, that it took the stamina of an Olympic athlete to be a circus band musician. The reason I bring this up is that I just thought of it when I spoke of Harry James. So one day I was talking with Merrill about how his musicians, they're playing a waltz, la-da-dee-dee-dee, dee-dee-dee-dee, and then a whistle blows and they go da-da-da-dee-dee-da-da-da-dee, from without a cue of anything music in front of them, they'd blow that loud whistle and they'd shift into another type of music to fit the act that's going on. It was a superior performance by athletes to keep up with these guys. So we were talking about the various ones, and I said, well, could any of the dance musicians today, Merrill, would they be able to live through this life that you guys put up with? He said, no, he can't think. He says, yes, yes, one, Harry James. And he says, that's because he was born under a tent, in a big tent. He was the son of circus performers in one way or another, but his early days were with the circus, which I thought was an unusual story about stamina among musicians.
You had mentioned a little while ago, not on tape, that Paul LaValle is still rather active. And I was a little surprised, but happily surprised. I remember Paul LaValle, as I'm sure most do, with the band of City Service Band of America.
That's right.
Did you ever work with Paul?
Oh, yes. Yes, I worked with... I knew Paul from... He had been a regular staff musician with NBC at 711 Fifth Avenue till he began to get programs of his own. Whether he stayed on staff then, I doubt it. I think he probably went independent. But he did City Service for a long time and became almost a member. Maybe he was on the board or heavens knows what. I think he was employed by City Service long after the program went off the air. I know he was employed to go around and form bands in universities and towns all over America, sponsored by City Service. It was one of their promotion things. Now, in recent years, maybe that developed from City Service, that type of presentation, but each Thanksgiving Day parade was the McDonald Band of America with kids, I think, two from each state in the Union. Then they had auditions to win that honor. And a tremendous band. They did a wonderful job. Paul, I think the last year or two were the first ones that he's no longer been the bandmaster for the Band of America and for McDonald's.
I was not aware of that at all. We had a youngster from our high school, as a matter of fact, yeah, who was selected for this organization.
What high school is that?
That's Croton Harmon High School.
Croton Harmon, good.
little local commercial. Yeah. But we had a youngster who was selected for that band, and it had never occurred to me when I learned about it that Paul LaValle was associated with it.
When was that?
I think 2 years ago.
Well, he might have done it 2 years. I don't know whether he's been out of it more than a year or 2 years. I don't know which, but that was Paul's, and he's living very comfortably. I think for the whole time after the City Service, he was still on their payroll of the City Service Company for years after the program went off the air. And part of that probably was as consultant and as a touring goodwill ambassador in music, forming bands and aiding or conducting bands in various cities under the aegis of City Service.
Tell me about some of the vocalists that you've worked with, and not only who they were, but what they were like to work with, if you would, Ward.
Gee, I think all of them. I think I worked with all of them that are certainly not in favor now with the MTV movie thing. Movie videos or TV videos, any of that. But the Helen O'Connells, the Margaret Whitings, the just mention them. I'm going blank. But any one of them were Doris Day. I had for 13 weeks. I'd done her shows with the Fitch Bandwagon when she was with Les Brown, but then one of the summer series for 13 weeks, Les Brown was the attraction on the show, along with other with guest artists. And he, Doris was with him at that time. So for 13 weeks, she was a beautiful child, just a wonderful girl. And to show you what a beautiful, wonderful concept I have of talent and how I can pick them, I'm so proud of this fact that when Doris was pretty young then, and she came in one day crying, and often she just was not in a good mood to rehearse. She didn't like it at all. She'd had a slightly unhappy marriage before. This was before the publicized bad marriage. And she was crying one day, and she's so beautiful and such a nice kid. And I said to her, Doris, you realize the rest of your life you're going to be hanging your clothes on steam pipes and miserable dressing rooms all over the country and all this. Why, you're not meant for this life. You shouldn't pursue this life at all. If I were you, I'd look for something else. Get out of it, because you sing beautifully, but this is not for you. See how I pick them? About 10 years after that, the Capitol, I think, had a big reception for her at Danny's Hideaway, and I was invited to that, and she was there with the then-husband, Marty Melcher, and she was greeting all the people in a group, and I came up in back of her and just whispered in her ear, said, Doris, you ought to get out of this business. She turned around and said, you, war. So, you see, I really picked him.
She remembered your advice.
Yeah, she should have paid my advice. I don't know what. Oh, dear.
Well.
So, as I say, it's good I'm not a talent scout.
When you had actors or comedians who were guests on some of the programs that you worked with, did you continue to write the scripts, or were there kinds of partnerships in terms of script writing? Did you work with any other writers?
No. Most of the shows I did were my own, where I did the writing and direction and production. But when I got with the B.O. Company and did Lever Brothers and what else? I can't think there. I did Philip Morris and that. Then we had writers. I had writers, and I just kind of ride herd on them. But speaking of comedians, you spoke of Zero Mostel a while ago. I'll never forget. Zero, on some program in the 30s, and I don't know what it was. I wasn't there, and I know nothing, but I know he'd gotten a bad blackball by being going on and stretching his part, and really loused up a show in timing and everything else by not sticking to the script. And he was funny, he was bringing down the house, but it got so bad that people couldn't depend on him, they weren't going to take him. And so his agent, whoever it was, I forget whether he was MCA or William Morris or what, had trouble booking him for quite a long time. And then we came up on a Lever Brothers show, I forget which one it was, when I was at B.O., and they booked Zero on for me, and with the promise that he was going to stick to this. Well, wise guy Byron says, yeah, he'll stick to it, I know. So I prepared a big stretch part, we call it, a big blank, to maybe a minute there, 2 minutes, where I knew that he was going to fill that. And you just couldn't depend on him not doing it. So we went on. Zero played it right to the letter. And played it. I was stuck with a minute or 2 minutes at the end of the show with nothing going on. Ray Block was the orchestra leader. I know he played the theme over and over again. The announcer announced and ad-libbed to who the people were on. And it seemed like an hour dragged by getting that show off the air. I never had had that experience before of being out more than a few seconds, 5 or 10 seconds on a show, but this one was a nightmare, and all because Zero did exactly what he said he was going to do.
A few years later, Zero Mostel was one of those people who had been blacklisted for association with left-wing organizations. Did you know him at that time?
Or? No, not really. No, I didn't. I never had. As I say, that was about the only show I ever did that Zero was on. Mm. Was the I think it was Lever Brothers.
What was Ray Block like to work with?
Oh, Ray Block was an absolute little dynamo. He was one of the most capable production directors that I'd ever worked with, one of the fastest and best. It would be like Al Goodman used to be that way in the very early days of Rudy Vallee shows and that sort. That he didn't do Rudy Vallee, but that type of show, big show. Al, he was very good. But Ray was a craftsman. Everything was prepared and done, and an emergency happened, he'd handle it, so forth. And was his very speed and ability to get a show on and off with no trouble at all, probably gave him the reputation of not being the very artistic musical director with great feeling and depth for his music. Well, you didn't have time for that. This wasn't Carnegie Hall. It was radio, and he was one of the best.
Speaking of Ray Block, he worked for Edgar Bergen and Charlie McCarthy for a while. Did you ever work with Bergen and McCarthy?
Or? No, I didn't know Ray did.
I thought he did. Maybe I may be giving some misinformation now.
Who was their band leader?
Robert Armbruster, out in Hollywood for the.
Feeling it was Ray Block for a while.
No. Bobby Armbruster was the conductor that I recall. They might have been someone before him. Was it Ray Noble?
Ray Noble.
Ray Noble was earlier when they used the name band. Yeah.
There were constant jokes about his bald-headedness.
That's right. So that, but then he was followed in the latter part for a long time with by Bobby Armbruster.
At least I got half of the name right. Can you tell me about any of the comedians other than Zero Mostel that you might have worked with? Did you ever work with Fanny Bryce or?
No, never with Fanny. No, but well, you see, in San Francisco, and I had such a run of them that I can't remember them all. Only one I can think of is Mari Amsterdam, that I had with Meredith Wilson. What I went out the coast, I think, what I was brought out there for actually, in 35, was their top show was called Carefree Carnival, and it had been on for, I guess, a couple of years before I was there, on and off. It was never steady, but it was their big show. Their big variety show was the Carefree Carnival. Well, I think because I was with Raymond Knight, who was noted for comedy and in New York, that they thought I'd be the one. I wanted to go to the coast anyway, and so I had applied and been accepted, and I think they said, this is the guy we'll put on with the Carefree Carnival. So that's when I started with Meredith Wilson and the Carefree Carnival. That was an hour show that I had to write, direct, and produce, an hour, which no one would ever think of doing today with the gang of writers you have. But I finally got help, and I'm glad you've reminded me of this one, because I wanted to pay tribute to him, about 1937, 36, 37, they said I was going to get help, going to have a writer coming in. And he'd be up one day to see me, and I didn't know when it was. So I was up in some little piano studio with a piano recital guy, and I was falling asleep there, and the announcer was falling asleep in the corner as the piano recital went on, a typical filler, sustaining show. And the doors opened, the studio, and a guy walked in with the brim of his hat turned up like an old farmer, and his belt pulled way below his stomach so it hung out, and he looked like a real farmer. I think he even had the straw in his mouth, and walked right into the studio, walked up to the mic and said, "Calm is the night, calm is the day, calm rover," and walked out. And I fell off my chair, and the announcer didn't know what to do, says, "We've had a slight interruption," or something or other. And that was Ransom Sherman. And Ransom, he became my co-writer, and of course performed on the show too. And I never had a better and funnier program to work on, working with Ransom. Ransom was a benevolent Don Rickles. If that, I've never heard that used before, and maybe no one knows what I mean. He wasn't as hard-hitting as Don Rickles, but he was a put-on artist. Everybody he talked to, he had knew a great deal more of their subject than they knew, and he was very definite about it, and he'd come in with just enough knowledge to confuse everybody. And he'd stand in front of a window where some girl was demonstrating a product. And that was a sight to see. And he'd have a straw in his mouth, his belt pulled way down, he'd get his nose in the window, and he'd watch everything they do. Well, you could see that they're saying to someone else, hey, get a load of this guy out here. And pretty soon there are a lot of people there watching this character out there, and he's got the person by this time so confused that's doing the demonstration. But Ransom was just wonderful, and he's retired, I think, now. But in fact, I just got his address a couple weeks ago. I'm going to write him a letter.
He has been a guest on many, many programs as a comedian, and I think he had his own show for a while.
Sure. Well, he had started out before this, but the first I was aware of, there was a show out of Chicago called The Three Doctors, and that was Ransom Sherman and I can't think who else. Then, of course, after my Carefree Carnival days, he came back to Chicago and did the Gary Moore, the club matinee with Gary Moore. When Gary was in Chicago.
Where do you think he's living now?
Yes, I have his address at home, but I can't think where it is.
Do you know what state it is?
It's, I can't remember.
West Coast or
New York? Yeah, it's West Coast, or it's in the mountain area somewhere, the mountains range. Mountain zone.
I have a feeling there are a lot of people who would love to be able to speak to him and get some of his
well,
memories.
Well, I'm going to write him a letter or give him a call even the next week or so.
Now, you mentioned Carefree Carnival, and I raced over to my files and see that you're right. Meredith Wilson was on that. I have one program where I guess Vera Vague.
Vera Vague was
one of the comedians.
She was my gal out there because she was a stronghold. She did her name was Barbara Jo Allen, right. And a lovely, wonderful gal. And she pretty much wrote her own script for it. I edited and went over it with her, but she was so creative and so good. And of course, out of that got the Bob Hope went to. Bob Hope show from the Carefree Carnival. Another one there that is not recognized by anyone much, but because she was short term, but was her name was Helen Troy, and she was Susie of the Switchboard, and she did an act like the girl of today in television. What's her name?
Oh, yes, I know who you mean.
The funny voice wearing that name. Hello, ringy dingy. What's her name? Well, everyone knows when I say that, ringy-dingy. Well, Helen was that type, but she was long before her, and was Susie of the Switchboard, and she was a darling girl. She was just great. Now, she came from the Carefree Carnival to the Eddie Cantor Show and became Susie of the Switchboard as a regular on Eddie Cantor's show for 6 months, a year, maybe one contract, I don't know.
Several people had switchboard on. Bob Hope had, not Bob Hope, Jack Benny had the two
the
switchboard
old,
operators.
The old ladies,
And when I think about Vera Vague, I also think about Brenda and Cobina. Do you remember those?
Yeah, I remember them. Never worked with them. Don't know them at all.
Blue Jay Footpads, was that the company that sponsored the show when you were with it?
Yes. Blue Jay. Yes, they were for one season or one contract. Blue Jay. I remember. Ransom doing a phony commercial for Blue Jay on the thing. Yeah.
Were you on live on most of these?
Oh,
programs,
these were all live.
Did you do any
well,
of
now,
these programs?
No. Now, you've brought up a subject that I think. I'm not unique, but I'm among those who suffered this problem. I missed all the switches as though fate had me destined to work hard. When I left Perry Como, was in 1949, and if you check your records, you'll find out some part of 49, early or late, was when Bing Crosby won his fight with ABC and had his Ampex, because he was interested in that, and forced them to accept his shows on tape. So I went from doing two shows, as you know, Dave, they used to have the repeat show for the West Coast. So I'd do 7 to 7:15, 5 days a week, then 3 days a week later, Monday, Wednesday, and Friday with Como. And we'd finish at 7:15 and have to wait around till 11 or 11:15 at night. I forget whether it went on 11 or 11:15. And we'd have to go to Tooth Shores and sit around and just wait and come back and do the show. Well, a couple months after I left, they went tape. Everything went tape. Now, in the meantime, I'd gone into television. And I did the Paul Whiteman Goodyear Review and a couple others, the Langford Amici show, 5 days a week, beating her brains out on live television, which was fun and but exciting, but pretty darn difficult. And so when I left them to go with the Milton Bio agency, for the Lennon and Newell agency, at that time I left in 52 because ABC was waiting word from Washington on their merger with Paramount, you may remember, and they had to get approval of the deal. And so for a couple of months we went black, as they say in television, went dark in our various studios, outside theater studios, because nothing could be done. We're spending no money, just treading water until the approval came by. Well, I said, gee, I don't want to sit around waiting for this. They're suddenly going to look at me and say, what are we paying this guy for? So I had wanted to go into agency work and to try that, and so I went to Lennon Newell Agency. Now, well, I'm at Lennon Newell probably 6 months, maybe a year, but sounds like 6 months later, in came tape and film, at least film for the commercials started, where we did commercials live, and I'd say they first started with the commercials, but then pretty soon everything went to tape, so I said I missed it again. So I'm sorry you brought that up. It makes me think how hard I had to work.
A pioneer, a true pioneer. I was fascinated to hear earlier about the organization that you belong to in New York, the Dutch Treat Club, because you had mentioned that as a member of that organization, you have developed friendships with some people who are legends,
yeah,
in radio and in other fields, particularly Alexander Wolcott,
yeah,
Lowell Thomas, Robert Benchley, and others. Could you kind of talk a little bit about some of these individuals in terms of your own impressions of someone like Wolcott or Benchley?
Well, no, I never knew Wolcott. I mean, I told you the story of how I was pulling a thing that I thought I was getting away with, of telling a story personalized to my own tailoring. When he did it on the air, and it finally brought me up short, and I said, I can't use that anymore. And so I never knew him. I saw him because he was doing the Town Crier, it was called at that time, and I was then with NBC at 711 Fifth Avenue. Benchley, too. I only bumped into him a couple times at the Garden of Allah in Hollywood, but I never knew him well. I knew his son, Nat Benchley, and I became very good friends. And but the others were radio people at this club where Lowell Thomas was our president. We're a bitter blow when we lost him a couple years ago as president of the club. And there were John Charles Thomas, Bobby Armbruster, Gene Lockhart, any of the people of the day, of the top stars. Many of them were members of the club that we worked with, some of them, but knew most of them.
When you were on live, other than the time that you ran a couple of minutes short because you expected a Zero to clown around and he didn't, can you recall any flubs that might have caused anyone any embarrassment?
Oh, yes, but they can't be told on the air. Most of the flubs.
We're not on the air now. Yeah,
no, but I think, there's one, and it's not radio, but it's so allied with it, I have to tell you, in television, that I would gladly pay, I don't know how much, but right now I'd say $100 to anyone that has a kinescope of it, but I don't think it exists. I don't think we made kinescopes. But in 1950 or 51, I was I took the job of doing the commercials because I was at ABC. I was executive producer of television at ABC. But Robert Kintner, who many will remember his name, was president of the company. And I was given permission to write the commercials for the famous old radio show, Can You Top This? Now, this was a strange thing. They said you can do it and make and accept a fee for the thing because they don't know how to convert their radio commercials to television. And
who was the sponsor? Do you recall?
The sponsor was Mogan David Wine. That's what I'm coming to as oh boy. So they had an agency, Weiss and Geller, in Chicago. And they said, great, they'd pay me, I forget what it was, but it was pretty good loot to do the, readapt their commercials. Well, with these nice old gentlemen of Senator Ford, Joe Lowry Jr., Harry Hirschfield, and Peter Donald as MC, all of them have had a touch of the grape every now and then to a point of where they were pretty good at it. And they would practically to get sick at my commercials because they advertise what I was given to advertise was Mogan David Longfellow's the highball out of this sweet wine, Mogan David on the rocks, Mogan David all sorts of ways, and they'd clown around the background. Ugh, oh terrible, they, not their type of drinking. So I got pretty tired of writing these commercials and was looking for a new way to do it, a new way to put them on. Suddenly I thought, wait a minute, I'm going to do a Lucius Beebe type of thing or a Man of Distinction with his elbow on a mantelpiece, everything but the patch over the eye. And I said, I'll do an elegant commercial. So there's a thing they call a mirror box. You have mirrors made into a corner where they meet like corners of a wall, and the you put something in that corner of the mirror and you shoot it at a certain angle with the camera and you see thousands of them stretch out. It's a camera illusion. So I said I put the glass of Mogan David there. Well, that worked for a while and everything was fine. And they said, oh, could they do more inventive commercials? So suddenly I thought, now I'll do this Lucius Beebe act. So I wrote a commercial in sheer elegance, saying, starting out to the effect that we think of eavesdropping, that's by the ear, that's an oral pursuit. But I wonder, with this new medium of television, which it was then, could we eavesdrop by television? Well, let us see. And with that, the camera cut down to the apron, as we call it, from the apron down to the floor of the theater we were in. And you wouldn't see the audience when we shot down at that angle because they're 20 feet back from the apron. And I needed an actor. Well, then I thought, why should I pay an actor? I'll do it myself. So I got out, I had a club chair arranged with an end table with all the ingredients on it, and a reading lamp, and I'm in a dressing gown with my back to the camera, and I've got a book there, and I stretch my arms out and hold the book out and put it across my knees and reach over to the ingredients on the table.
Live.
All the time, the announcer is droning away. Now, this gentleman at home, he seems to be spending a pleasant evening, and he seems to be a gentleman of good taste, because we see on the table at his left the sparkling decanter of Mogan David wine, and we see the tall glass, the ice cubes. Now, but does this gentleman really know the proper in a way to mix a Mogan David Longfellow? Let us see. So the camera now tightens up to the end table with the ingredients there. And he says, pardon me, yes, he does know. He's poured half a glass of Mogan, sparkling Mogan David. Now 3-4 cubes of ice from the ice bucket, which I place with the tongs in. And now a touch of seltzer. Of soda. And now the soda was those bottles you get in professional bottles that are sealed at the top that mm-hmm. have the siphon thing. You don't see them around very much, but they were very heavy glass and they're, you know what they are. So anyway, it seems that the stagehand kept that bottle on the steam pipes. down the stairs. So it came in, and I says, now a touch of soda. And I hit the soda. It went down one side of the glass, up the other, and ice cubes, Mogan David wine, and all went at least 7 feet in the air all over me.
Live.
Dripping live, dripping down my arm. The camera, all they could see was my shoulders shaking. I was breaking up. The audience broke up. The three old boys on the show hung on to each other, got into hysterics, and while all this chaos is going on, the announcer is saying, and so this gentleman is spending a relaxing evening at home, enjoying the better things of life. And the TD, we called him, technical director, which was a good hi-hat name for the engineer, he had fallen under the desk practically. He couldn't reach the things. The director of the show was broken up. He was roaring with laughter. It took us, I would say, a good minute to get back on the air with that. Now imagine if I had a tape on that for home consumption, for showing that.
Well, that was very appropriate for Can You Top This. If
yeah,
you were doing a more
yeah.
serious program, they might have thought you
oh,
were, that had been
oh,
planned.
The payoff is that all those in this business will appreciate the PS to this. I said, well, I've blown that. I'm not going to get that check anymore, putting on these commercials for Weiss and Geller and Mogan David. Never heard a word. I think that they thought something went on that they didn't understand and they didn't want to admit that they didn't get it.
You know,
so I got away with it.
I've listened to a lot of the Can You Top This shows.
Yeah,
I'm
yeah.
sure you have also.
Oh, boy.
I wondered sometimes whether or not those programs were actually rehearsed, whether the jokes that Senator Ford and Harry Hirschfield and Joe Lurie Jr. told, presumably to match up the joke that the contestant sent
yeah.
in, were off the cuff, or whether they were
sometimes
jokes that they had ready.
Sometimes they were off the cuff, but most of the time they'd say taxi joke. They'd say one thing is going to deal with a small boy in school. One deals with a woman hanging out laundry. A laundry joke. You'd get a topic, but they wouldn't rehearse what they were going to say, actually.
But they knew the topic in advance.
They might have known. I'd say most of the time they knew the topic, but
so
sometimes they'd spring one on them just to see what
they had
happened.
A supply of jokes at home. Sometimes
not at
I'm
home.
Sure they
knew them. Right in their head, they were rememberers. Harry Hirschfield was one of the most delightful storytellers, a great as an MC at dinners and parties. He was just perfect.
They did a lot of dialect stuff
oh, yes.
on the air. Did
yeah.
they do their dialect stuff on TV as well?
Yep. Every now and then they'd go in for the dialect stuff.
Speaking of dialect, and this may be a sensitive question, but I'm going to raise it because we talked about this earlier as well. Nowadays, if anyone dared to play Amos and Andy on the radio, they'd be they'd probably be banned from the air. There was a great deal of dialect type of humor on the radio in the 30s and 40s. Jack Benny with Rochester and Amos and Andy and several others. You told me kind of off tape before a little story about a situation involving a black musician,
Count Basie.
Okay,
yeah.
could you kind of repeat?
Well,
that?
There's not much to repeat except the fact that they wanted my script in to have Count Basie refer to the MC as Mr. Reddy. His name was Tom Reddy, where everyone else called him Tom, and I wouldn't have it. We won that fight. It was it was just fear of NBC and a client. That the southern stations would resent it, and they didn't want to lose an audience or anything, which is so different today. That's been beat. I'm 100% for what has happened there, that we don't have that problem anymore. But I am also very, very regretful of the fact that you can't have the Weber and Fields and the Amos and Andes and so forth. The super sensitivity of races, of minorities and races, that they seem to be looking for things to be hurt over. Whereas the great, great comics of all times could tell racial stories, but not on the air, not in television. They do it in public, in the things, and they've lost a great literature of comedy. It's not a good expression. They've lost a complete field that should be done, that I think, if anything, makes you appreciate the minority and the races more than trying to, oh no, this will insult them. I think it's sheer nonsense. I feel very badly about that. Who was I trying to think of the other day that I was on the road with Jessel for a year. I didn't tell you that. I went, we did a co-op show.
Was that when he was married to Norma Talmadge?
Norma, yes, and Norma went along with us, so forth. Well, Jessel would tell the greatest stories on a Hungarian, and of course his Jewish stories were great, but now why aren't they allowed? If Georgie can tell them, then they seem to be accepted, although not often on the air. They don't want to go in for that. They're careful about it. But I just think there's much too much of that sensitivity thing.
Was there, as a writer, what kind of censorship existed in the radio? How many days prior to broadcast did you have to submit your script? And were there many changes made in scripts? And if there were, what were some of the reasons?
Reasons were clients, were advertising agencies, were the stars themselves and everything. That is the story where I probably was the... I just disturbed all my fellow writers, producers, and directors. They probably hated me for it. Just... I don't mean hate in their true sense, but they'd say, oh, you, boy. I'll tell you the truth. I had the Fitch thing for 6 years, and I would go out to the coast to Lord and Thomas. That was what the agency was before it became Foote, Cone, and Belding. I was on the road with Jessel for a year. I didn't tell you that. I went, we did a co-op show.
Was that when he was married to Norma Talmadge?
Norma, yes, and Norma went along with us, so forth. Well, Jessel would tell the greatest stories on a Hungarian, and of course his Jewish stories were great, but now why aren't they allowed? If Georgie can tell them, then they seem to be accepted, although not often on the air. They don't want to go in for that. They're careful about it. But I just think there's much too much of that sensitivity thing.
Was there, as a writer, what kind of censorship existed in the radio? How many days prior to broadcast did you have to submit your script? And were there many changes made in scripts? And if there were, what were some of the reasons?
Reasons were clients, were advertising agencies, were the stars themselves and everything. That is the story where I probably was the... I just disturbed all my fellow writers, producers, and directors. They probably hated me for it. I don't mean hate in their true sense, but they'd say, oh, you, boy. I'll tell you the truth. I had the Fitch thing for 6 years, and I would go out to the coast to Lord and Thomas. That was what the agency was before it became Foote, Cone, and Belding. Many of my very good friends worked there and at other agencies. And I'd walk in a meeting where they've got teletypes practically from the ceiling to the floor that they've written, change this and get this paragraph out of here and so forth. And the client says this. Well, the greatest example would be George Washington Hill, who rode herd on his programs as no one has ever ridden herd before. And these guys were tearing their hairs out, having to rewrite it at midnight and get it ready for tomorrow and get it approved back to New York and all this. Now, I would look at them and say, well, I have to go home and write the Fitch script for a day after tomorrow or something, and I'll be in Chicago. I would write the script. I would mail a copy to the agency, which was a Des Moines, Davenport, Iowa agency, and then I'd go 2 days later to the hotel that I was, they'd know I'd be in. I'd look, any mail? Yes, there'd be two commercials written out, commercials with not one word in them, just the commercials. I'd insert them anywhere in the program that I wanted, and I'd go this way week after week, and sometimes I'd pick up the phone after a show and call the Fitch Company or the agency. Hey, are you fellows listening? They, oh no, everything's fine, we're happy. So these friends of mine would say, how do you get away with that? I said, I don't know, it's the way it started. And for 6 years, I can't recall any time when they sent anything other than a suggestion about, in this commercial, could you get so-and-so, or in this commercial, would you put it to follow this? Once in a while they do that, but otherwise I don't remember anything ever being dictated. And when I saw what all my fellow workers were going through to get a program on the air, for 8 years, I lived a charmed life.
You think that was the results of the Fitch people being so liberal?
No.
Or was that...
Can't tell. They were strange. They were a wonderful gang. They were Midwestern. The radio to them was... they were selling enough Fitch shampoo to float the Queen Mary. Now, the way this... I got a great rib from Meredith Wilson on that. He said, well, we did. We had a wonderful time spot. It was the greatest. I followed Jack Benny and was followed by Edgar Bergen. Well, what a time spot in there. So Meredith, in some interview somewhere, said, well, he says, Byron and that Fitch bandwagon, you could read the Brooklyn telephone directory in that spot and get a rating. So I wrote back to him and said, when you find the person that reads the Brooklyn telephone directory for this for these number of points and Hooper rating, we had Hooper then, I said, I'll hire him. And it's true, I admit, was a wonderful time spot, but they had that same time spot before the name bands came in there, and they didn't do anything. It was not that big.
And when the name bands went off, was that when Phil Harris went on?
Yep. Well, Phil was one of our pets anyway. I did several shows with him, and they wanted to emanate from Hollywood, and I didn't want to go and live in Hollywood. That was number one. Number two, and I think they were ready to change me, too, by that time, because I was getting interest in other things. So there were no hard feelings. In fact, the last member of the Fitch family, his name is Lucius Fitch, lives in Sun City, and is that Arizona?
Yes.
Yeah. And he writes to me, he's compiled a very fine book. I think I told you about it on the phone, Dave. It's a vanity press thing of the Fitch family, but all the records of the company and what they did in radio and so forth.
Love to have a copy of that.
I'll get you a copy of that. So anyway, we've kept a very good association since, but... I don't think they ever came up. Phil Harris and Alice, Phil and Alice, it was finally called. It wasn't the bandwagon anymore. And they came up. I don't know whether they topped our ratings or how much they topped it. It was a very popular show. But they swung in the same hammock I swung in. So
Elliot Lewis, I think, was on their show.
Yes, Elliot. Very dear friend of mine at the time when I was in Hollywood. He was married to Kathy Lewis.
Kathy Lewis.
She's
sweet. Passed away.
She did.
The little boy who played the Greek Gildersleeve was on that show also. Walter Tetley, who I think also was gone.
Well, yes, I think he has. I knew Walter Tetley. Walter Tetley played on was one of the characters on my Ray Knight kids show that I told you about 5 days a week.
Was he on that?
Oh, yes, he was an Easterner
here. I think of Walter Tetley as being just a teenager when he was on with Gildersleeve.
Walter Tetley was small in stature, and he never changed much. That voice was one of the most talented radio performers that ever lived. He could be this little kid forever and ever. And I never forget my best description of Walter Tetley was, well, he played with me, he probably 13, 14, 15 when he played with me with Wheatonville. Then some years later he went out to Hollywood and he was out there and everything, many things, heavens knows what, Gildersleeve, and as you say, the
Phil Harris.
To everything. He was a sort of a guy, you wanted to murder him, because as a kid, you'd read a line that you didn't like the reading, and you'd start to push the button to say, Walter, would you do? And he'd wave it, don't call. And he'd do it over exactly what you wanted. He knew it before you'd tell him.
He had such a distinctive voice, though. You could not.
Oh, yes.
You could never
He was so good, but on his age, people never could figure out how old Walter was because they had him placed as 12, 13, when he was probably in his 30s by the time. And my best memory of the conflict over his age was provided by Ben Grauer. We were sitting around one night, and someone said, "What the hell, Walter Tetley? He's got to be about 20 now, doesn't he?" And Grauer said, "20? Walter was a busboy at the Last Supper." Oh dear.
So, he was on Wheatonville.
Yeah, not as a steady character, but he played on it many times. We used many characters. Our regular performers on that were Ray Knight and a girl named Alice Davenport. Not the Alice Davenport, maybe I've got her name wrong. It was Alice something, and I think Davenport, but there is another Alice Davenport, a famous old radio performer. But I don't think our Alice did much more than Wheatonville. She married after that. Then the boy was Jordan, Bobby Jordan, who showed up in the Dead End Kids later.
Oh, yes, with Billy Hallop.
But Billy Hallop was on the show at times. He was a part of it. And the little girl was Emily Vass, V-A-S-S.
Family. That's funny. There's a relative of the Vass family, or remember the Vass family, who lives in Croton.
Oh, really?
And a couple of months ago, I had never heard of the Vass family.
Yeah, yeah.
And some time ago, a local minister, who was a... Well, we lost the tape, then we're still on. A local minister who was a friend of mine loaned me some records that the Vass family had made.
They were great.
I've played them, and most of the people who know radio don't seem to have ever heard of the Vass family.
I know. That's too long ago, but they were lovely people, a mother and the old girls and a couple of boys. I forget how many, but I knew all of the girls, and mine was Emily Vass, who was the youngest. Mm-hmm. Now, the thing that always intrigued me was that you referred to them as the Vass family, and if only half of them showed up, how would you refer to them?
I'm not going to repeat that, even on tape.
Oh, that's good. But anyway, one of the sisters married a neighbor of mine in Douglas and Long Island, Water. Her name was Water or Waters. I forget which. Very lovely gal. They were
a
swell
family. If you're interested, I might be able to put you in touch with one of the members of the Vass family today.
It's good. It's Emily, and I got a picture of all of them at home. Mm. Yeah. Well, first ask if they remember me. All right.
Ward, what was the theme of Wheatonville?
Just like a soap opera, except without the suds. There were no tears in it.
Teenagers, basically?
It was just this bachelor bringing up two kids, and finally marries. We had a marriage on it, as all things did. He married Alice Davenport, and it was just fun.
Was that sustained, or did you have a
sponsor? No, that was commercial. That was Wheatonville.
Mm-hmm.
See, Wheatonville and Billy Batchelor and the twins.
Silly question for me to ask with a title like that. How many years was it on?
Two, I think. Two. We used to have to go down past Camden, somewhere around Camden, and read a week's scripts to the client, and just have them prove, and they'd fall asleep at the tables as we were droning on, mm-hmm. taking all parts in the thing and reading the scripts and that. Never much trouble with that. Never much many changes or anything.
Did you do any other radio work that was not related directly to music? Any other drama or was that?
Yeah, pretty much. I'm trying to think. I supervised a lot of them at BO Agency, for instance. I was on, and I was Eastern Radio Director when FBI
bum,
Peace
bum,
and War.
Bum, 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 bum.
You want to know how that happened? Now I'll tell you that.
Okay.
Story, see? You get me into these things.
That's my intention.
They had that theme, which is Love of Three Oranges, mm-hmm. and so forth, and that went on, how are you doing on tape?
We're fine.
A look. All right. And they were, I forget where they rated, but the show was way up in the ratings. I forget where, but doing more than good, but they weren't selling the product. And if you remember, the product was lava soap. So they, Milton Beale, then the president, said to me, "You got to get what we call sponsor identification. We need sponsor identification for this thing." So at that time, they were just coming in, experimenting with a thing called Sonatone, or that doesn't sound right. But anyway, it was the microphone, little mics that were put at your throat, and you'd talk over a musical note, and you'd give a word, and it would come out in music, and with a music tone, rather. What the devil was the name of the thing? It never got over, never too successful. So I thought, well, I'll try that. So we tried that, but it didn't work out. So I got a bass. I think I could almost remember his name. Harry Stanton, I think it was. Bass baritone singer. And put him in a big echo chamber with kettle drums. Outside the bong bong, had them tuned to the thing and got it the same as the are you doing all right? Doing got it the same as the tone as the theme itself, and had the bass in the echo chamber say L-A-V-A yum bum 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 into the tone. I think within a month we came from one of the lowest sponsor identification to one of the highest, and just that little LAVA.
One gimmick.
Yep.
And the lava soap company must have loved you.
So you bring up these things that I haven't thought of in years.
Well, if I can tickle your memory in any other way, I'd be delighted to do so.
Well, I think you're going to have to tickle me off this chair and into my car. I'm going to have to take it off, Dave.
Ward, I have rarely enjoyed an afternoon as well as I have this afternoon. I want to thank you so much for visiting, for sharing memories with me, and I don't know how many other people will get to hear this tape, but I know that those who will have enjoyed it as much as I, because they're all people who love old radio.
Good. Good. Well, Dave, I enjoyed it in your room with these tapes. I'm so impressed I can't see straight. I never knew that there was a collection like this. It's just, well, it's a gold mine for me with things for the future that I'm trying to prepare for, and I have absolutely no memory for things unless someone spurs me into it. Like you mentioned the lava bum bum de bum. I never would have thought of the story if you hadn't. I'd forgotten it.
Ward Byron, thank you so much.
Thank you, Dave.
Okay. Let me give you your tape.